the year when I was still back on University Avenue, of course, in town. And actually I started the 1st of October, 1957. And it was kind of interesting, and those, like, you know, at that time the lab was under contract with the Atomic Energy Service. And the, at that time the fiscal year ran from October 1st to October, you know, mm-hmm. instead of July or June, whatever. Yeah. And when they hired me, it was the way it was put that this was like in the middle of September or early September or something like that. And the way it was put that if the lab was still there on October 1st, I had the job and it's never been any different. We never knew from one year to the next, you know, whether things mm-hmm. were going to be renewed or, you know, it was crazy. And it's always been that way ever since. But at that point, my background was industrial electronics mainly, and so I was assigned to work with Charlie Pruitt on that small accelerator that was known as the Michigan model, which had been built at the University of Michigan, and then, which was a member, of course, and then when the lab moved to Madison, you know, that machine came with. And then as you know, that was the old Nash Garage building we were in there on mm-hmm. University Avenue. And in that great big room just across from the Michigan model that I worked on, was another accelerator of a little different design, called the Illinois model. And that had a different magnet design. I think they were called spiral sectors. They were curved, and the one on the Michigan model were different design.
So the Illinois model was in town in Madison?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was in the same big room there in the Nash Garage where we were. And so mainly, you know, what I did with Charlie was, you know, keep the machine running, and yeah, we did various physics experiments, you know, and stuff on that machine. At one point there was talk of, nothing ever happened on it, but there was, somehow or another there was some talk about moving that machine to Switzerland. It might have been whenever CERN was in those days, I don't remember anymore, but nothing ever came of it. But anyway, Charlie and I would have gone with it, had that happened, but nothing ever happened.
What was the nature of the Illinois model?
Well, the Illinois model was, it was just a one-way accelerator also, but it had a different kind of magnet design from the Michigan model. And I never really had a heck of a lot to do with the Illinois model. I worked on the electronics for the machine model and magnet power supplies and all that kind of stuff. The vacuum system. As I recall, both of those machines, the magnets were the windings on them were so susceptible to moisture, humidity in the air. They were hard to keep running. Boy, there was a lot of, you know, it was just. Never knew from one day to the next what the hell you're going to run into.
So,
but actually, as far as the experiments, you know, what the physics end of the experiments, other than just running them, I really never had much to do with that part of it, you know.
So then when did you hear about Tantalus and that was?
Oh, well, then of course, Mira was always involved in these huge proposals, you know, for bringing. Well, that was the purpose of Mira, you know, was to get a national accelerator to the Midwest, of course, which, you know, finally wound up at Fermilab. Mm-hmm. But I guess my understanding was that the reason Mira wound up in this area was because geologically this would have been such a good site, you know, for a machine of that kind. But anyway, besides those big proposals, and somehow or another, I don't quite remember how this all got started, but it was decided, work was begun on designing and then eventually building the 50 MeV machine, you know, which was a predecessor to Tantalus, which was up on the hill up here. And and it was going to be, let's see, did it? I'm trying to remember, did that start out? It was just known as the 50 MeV machine.
Michael, NASA, please call 2352.
I'm trying to remember, I think the reason for building that machine was to prove the two-way beam principle. And originally that was going to be built there in the lab on University Avenue, and then it was finally realized that there not only was enough room, but there was the radiation problems and all the rest of that junk. And so that's when the original, the back part of the lab up on a hill, that's totally underground, that's where the 50 MeV machine was built. And just, you know, worked on that from every aspect of building that thing, you know. And it was just, I don't know how many months we spent measuring the magnetic fields on those magnets, and just, you know, just went on and on and on.
So, does that have any relation to the FFAG?
Yeah.
That was it?
Yeah.
Oh, great, okay.
Yeah, I always knew it as a 50, it's the FFAG machine, yeah.
And that later went into Tantalus.
Yeah, that
as the injector.
As the injector, yes.
Okay, great. Great. So,
I'm sorry. Yeah, so you knew about that, but yeah.
Yeah.
As FFAG, okay.
Well, great. That actually, I had a question premeditated here, and I was wondering if you could just tell me a little bit more about the design of the FFAG and kind of the rationale for the positron and electron concepts.
I'm afraid I'm not going to be much help you on that aspect, because I was never really greatly involved in the physics aspect of things. I was more in the building and maintaining and the mechanical design and that, you know, fabrication and that kind of stuff.
Well, you can tell me about that.
But I remember somehow or another. After the magnets for the FFAG machine were machined at Fairbanks, Morris, and Beloit, and I can't remember where the coils were wound there or someplace else. I can't quite remember. But anyway, then there were all sorts of trim coils and correction coils on each one of those magnet sections, and so that had to be wound in, and somehow or another we ran two shifts of winding all these coils, and somehow or another I wound up as in charge of the morning shift. And I think we started at something like 5 o'clock in the morning or something like that, and that went on for it was a lot of work, and it was a long time to do that, and they were complicated. And it was all done by hand, of course. And then they had to be all, you know, insulated and coated with epoxy and all this kind of junk. And I remember we had some the kids that worked on that were all students, and boy, some of them were some real characters, as I recall. But anyway, that was. Then all that stuff had to be assembled, and then the machine. Oh, we worked on measuring the magnetic field. Went on and on and on forever. And in those days, you know, you didn't have all the. It was all done manually. There were. I can't think of what they call the new things, but in those days you had a little coil on the end of a long boom that stuck back into the gap of the magnets, and the coil had to be flipped back and forth, and then you looked, that was connected to a galvanometer, an optical galvanometer. Mm-hmm. And so one person would sit there and read this galvanometer and the beam on the scale. They were optical readouts on these things. And you sit there and read this thing and you say flip, and the guy over at the other end would turn his little shaft, you jot down the number, flip, flip, flip. Yeah, it was endless. And not only did so in the center of the ring, all the magnets were around. There was this post with a pivot with this boom, which ran out into the gap of the magnets. And so you not only, for each magnet, you not only ran the boom into the gap in increments, but also radially across the gap. You know, for each increment in it. And it just went on and on and on and on. And I forget how many magnets there were on that machine, but it was endless. But it all worked out, at least sooner or later. And so that all determined, you know, how much current each one of these correction coils, you know, got to get, you know, to obtain the uniform field that you wanted and all this. Mm-hmm. That went on for a long time. But,
do you remember what year this was, or time frame?
I would guess that was... Well, see, I started in the lab in the fall of 57. So that must have been... Well, probably 59 there's... I think 58, 59, early 60s maybe, something like that. I'm sure somewhere buried in all this stuff there must, I'm sure there's photos of all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, probably. I haven't had much conversation about the FFAG itself.
Mm-hmm.
Most of it is Tantalus.
Tantalus, yeah.
Going on, so maybe you could talk about that then. Your involvement with Tantalus.
Well, by the time we got to Tantalus, I was more involved with still the mechanical aspects of things. Like I did a lot of the electrical work on all those machines, and the cooling systems, and assembling the RF systems, that kind of stuff. The mm-hmm. The hell did we call it? That injecting thing was the magnetron? No,
microtron.
Yeah, microtron. Yeah, building that, winding the coils for that, assembling that, all that kind of stuff. Vacuum system too, all that stuff. God. And then as time sort of passed on, I started getting more and more and more involved with stuff going on at PSL.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course when the Aladdin stuff all started up, you know, it was the same thing all over again, you know, designing all that electrical distribution around the ring for the magnet power supplies, for example, was my responsibility. All those power supplies in the power room,
yeah,
down there, and all that kind of stuff.
That's
air conditioning and all the cooling system. God.
That's actually one of the missing links we have right now, is the construction of Aladdin. So maybe you could tell me a little bit about that, of more of the roles you did when Aladdin was being constructed.
Yeah, well, the... I remember there was Well, actually, I don't even know where to start. Well, I even got involved with the, you know, basic design of the building and so on. And here again, you know, part of the problems were the financial restraints.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, things would have been so much better I hadn't been able to afford to do it the right way the first time around. But as it turned out, you know, things worked out. But for example, at some point we discovered after all the magnets and everything were installed in place and so on, and then of course there was all the surveying to make sure everything, you know, was properly aligned and all this kind of stuff. And then we discovered that just setting the magnets on the floor wasn't working, and so that whole support system for the, you know, all the magnets had to be supported, and all had to be figured out and redone. What I worked on mainly on that in that part of the stuff was the electrical distribution of all the power around the ring for the magnets, and also the cooling system, all the plumbing for that, and the flow controls and
the cooling system for the magnets.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Because the main coils on the magnets are all water cooled. And
when you mentioned the alignment issues, were you referring to when they had to drill down to the bedrock to secure?
Yeah.
Did they do that at Tantalus as well?
No. Not that I'm aware. Not that I remember anyway.
So I'm wondering then, why did they build it out here when they said that it's suitable because of the bedrock below, if they didn't even really utilize the bedrock?
Well, for one thing, Tantalus was nowhere near as heavy as worked out. Or as big, you know.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, because we didn't even have that problem with the FFAG, as far as alignment was concerned. But the Tantalus magnets were so much heavier. And had the big machine, like, you know, Fermilab, you know, wound up here, they would have gone all the way to, you know, down to bedrock to begin with, you know, for that. But
how far down did they have to go?
I don't know, to tell you the truth. I don't remember.
I think it was Jim Taylor. He was telling me about some issues with, or no, it was Dave Huber. Tell me about issues of grounding with the cooling system.
Oh yeah.
Maybe tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, the even the I'm trying to remember what the reason for it is, but the see if I can remember why that was. But for some reason. You know, there's, you know, inside the ring, there's a cable tray that runs all, you know, all the way around the ring, for example, and all the bus bars and stuff are underneath that, in the, you know, in the support structure for that, and the cooling manifolds are all there. And for some reason, and I absolutely do not remember why this is, but we could not have a continuous loop around the inside. The cable tray, for example, had to be insulated in quadrants, from one quadrant to the next. And the same way with the big cooling manifolds underneath. And for some reason, if that was a continuous loop, it did something about the beam, but I don't remember what the physics are behind that anymore. But so there had to be an insulating section in all the manifolds as they went around the ring and the cable tray, and of course that whole support structure. And then I think at some point, eventually there were other, well, there was a ductwork system ran around inside the ring with all the, all the conventional, all the conventional power outlets and all this kind of stuff, and communication stuff was all in that cable duct. And then there was a compressed air line run around there. And finally, at some point, they got around this problem of not being able to have that as a continuous loop. But that's all physics stuff that I don't have a clue about. I don't think I'm helping you much here. I'm sorry.
No, this is just good. So did you work with John Stott?
Off and on. Not. I mainly worked with Bill Winter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, he was the head of the mechanical division, and I worked mainly with him, and of course with Ed Rowe. Got involved as well, and then Mike Green and Walt and all those guys, were all always involved in everything. We're all involved in everything all together. It was crazy.
That was one of my questions. It doesn't have a right answer at all, but as I've done the interviews, it just seems like so much of this was difficult because there was no guidebook, there was no manual of how to do
physics. Yeah, well, yeah. At that point, 90% of what we did was being done the first time.
Yeah.
And it was being done to prove that, that it was going to work or whatever. Yeah, so, there was, outside of some very basic physics principles, it was all done to prove that, to prove these theories or whatever.
Yeah.
Somebody come up with this bright idea. Yeah, let's see if we can do that and see if it'll work. There were some interesting people. They don't really do this anymore. I don't think. But the way back in the Mira days, there was something. I forget what the hell we called it, but there was a, well, because Mira was made up of the Big Ten universities. So every fall there would be this big conference. It would start like on Thursday and run through pretty much the whole weekend. And you'd have these big meetings and the various guys from all the various universities would come and present their papers and create all these discussions and so on. And it was either, I think it was on Friday night, there would be a soiree, more or less, of just an informal, big informal party with food, all kinds of foods. And then on Saturday night would be a big banquet always. And they were held at various places around the area, in town and so on. There was one, I was sitting here trying to think of his name. There was one interesting elderly, older fellow from from the University of Indiana, and it's a very, very brilliant guy, but he would come, and the minute he'd sit down, he'd go to sleep. And automatically, nobody ever had to wake him, that we would all watch him, because after a couple of years, we got to know what was going to happen, and he'd be sitting there sound asleep. When it came time for him to give his talk, he would automatically wake up, get up and give this incredible presentation, go back and sit down and immediately go back to sleep. And he was incredibly absent-minded. And one year he was either from the University of Indiana at Lafayette or or from Purdue, I can't remember, one of the two. But anyway, one year he drove here from wherever the hell he was in India, drove here, and then made arrangements to fly home. Then when he got back home, he couldn't figure out where the hell his car was. And we heard all about this, of course. His secretary called whoever this, you know, was the main secretary here, and asked if anybody knew where this guy's car was. And he was, I wish I could remember what his name was. He was a character, but a delightful person, you know. Absent-minded as they come. And brilliant, just incredibly brilliant.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's all the questions I have for now. Is there anything else you'd like to add as a whole of your career here?
Well, and then of course, at some, what the hell was it, back in, well, when we first started building a lab, both the labs, you know, were still as one, and then, mm-hmm. I can't remember what it was. Well, you know, whatever, the two labs split up, you know, when SRC became a separate entity from PSL. But I was still totally involved with both of the labs. Somehow or another, at one point, I even became, I wound up as the facility manager for the entire KRC campus over here. And before we had a separate safety director here at SRC, I was the safety director for the entire campus. I've gotten to the point where I'm a little embarrassed when people ask me how long I was here. Turned out it was 50 and a half years between Mira and, you know, and PSL. Okay. So anyway, I don't think I've